truly great businesses, earning huge returns on tangible assets, physically cannot, for any extended period, reinvest a large portion of their earnings internally at high rates of return.
Right, yeah.
Warren Buffett wrote that in 2007. And, you know, it establishes one of the most counterintuitive, almost, well, frustrating paradoxes in modern finance.
It really does.
Which is that the better a business is at generating returns, the less capable it actually is of absorbing its own wealth.
Yeah, and it forces this complete reassessment of what a perfect business model actually looks like, right? Because we are conditioned to think that an incredible return on invested capital means a company should just aggressively pour every single dollar right back into itself.
Exactly, just compound it forever.
But the mathematical reality of these elite businesses is structurally opposed to that instinct.
And that paradox is exactly the core of our deep dive today.
Mm-hmm.
We're unpacking the structural limits of high-return businesses, specifically exploring this concept called the price of free growth.
Which is a fascinating framework.
It is, yeah. And this analytical framework, it comes from the book The Infinite Investor, which is part of the broader Averaging Up collection.
Right.
We're going to examine the architectural constraints of the greatest companies on earth and really dig into why they eventually trap themselves in a mathematical corner.
Because understanding this requires looking way past, you know, surface level metrics. You actually have to analyze the physics of capital inside a corporation.
The actual mechanics of it.
Exactly. When you do that, you realize the very mechanism creating these massive returns is simultaneously acting as an iron ceiling.
An iron ceiling on growth.
Yes. It places a hard limit on how much of that return you, the shareholder, can actually capture over time.
Okay, let's unpack this by looking at what the framework calls the pure archetype of free growth, Visa.
Oh, Visa is the perfect example.
Right. If you're looking at Visa's metrics, they are almost absurd.
Yeah.
I mean, we are talking about a 38% return on invested capital, ROIC.
This is staggering.
And that figure is still rising. They spend less than 3% of their revenue on CapEx. You know, the physical stuff they need to buy to just keep the lights on and the network running.
Practically nothing.
Practically nothing, yeah. Yet they generate $34 billion in free cash flow. $34 billion just sitting there.
And to understand why those numbers exist, we have to clearly define what free growth actually means in this context.
Right, because it's not normal growth.
No, not at all. Visa's growth does not pass through its balance sheet. If you think about the global economy digitizing its payments as cash disappears, Visa's toll naturally widens.
They just collect more tolls.
Exactly. But Visa doesn't have to lay the asphalt for that new road. They don't have to deploy any massive amounts of capital to capture that widening revenue stream.
So the return is sky high, precisely because almost no capital is tied up in the business itself. But you know, if I'm listening to this right now, I'm probably screaming, well, if the business is so undeniably great, if it's yielding 38% on the capital it does use, why not take that $34 billion of free cash flow and just jam it right back into the business?
Which is the logical assumption.
Right. Let me throw an analogy at you. Imagine you have a magical bank account, and this bank guarantees you a 38% interest rate every single year.
Sign me up.
Right. You would fight tooth and nail to put every spare penny you own into that account. But there's a catch. The bank strictly caps your maximum balance. You are not allowed to just keep rolling your massive profits back into the account to compound.
And that magical bank account with a cap is exactly what the framework defines as the owner's dilemma.
The owner's dilemma.
Yes. The business earns 38%, but the shareholder does not actually earn 38% compounding over time.
Because they can't reinvest it all?
Precisely. Because Visa's operational base is simply too small to absorb that cash, so it has no choice but to eject the overflow.
Right. The internal reinvestment is essentially zero because there is no physical or operational base to feed.
Exactly. So what do? They pay a dividend yielding less than 1%, and they do stock buybacks that add roughly 3% to the per share value.
So as a shareholder, you're handed back this massive overflow of cash. You are basically forced to take it and find somewhere else in the broader market to put it.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, exactly. Because you are certainly not going to find another 38% return out there. Businesses that can absorb massive quantities of capital at 38% simply do not exist.
They don't. And that gap, the gap between that elite 38% ROIC the business generates and the much lower rate at which you, the owner, can actually compound that ejected cash in the market, that gap is the literal price of free growth.
The price of free growth. Wow.
Yes, you get the high rate, but you absolutely cannot scale the quantity.
I want to visualize this for a second because the infinite investor uses this geometric framework that makes it really, really clear.
The equilateral figure.
Yeah, the equilateral figure. It maps compounding out as this triangle, basically. So imagine a triangle. The height is the rate of return.
Right.
The length of the side is the duration, like how long that return lasts.
Yeah.
And the base of the triangle is the quantity, the sheer amount of capital the business can actually deploy.
So a free growth business like Visa achieves a very rare, almost perfect balance of massive rate and incredibly long
All
duration.
right. Wide moat, low uncertainty.
Exactly. But the structure itself demands a sacrifice. To maintain the shape of that figure, to keep that massive height, the third side, quantity, just cannot grow.
The base has to remain incredibly narrow.
It has to, mathematically.
So what happens then when a company looks at that narrow base, looks at that strict cap on quantity, and says, fine, we will just overflow forever?
They just lean into it entirely.
Right. They fully accept the limitation.
Yeah.
And the framework points to MSCI as the absolute extreme example of this behavior.
MSCI is fascinating.
The data here is wild. Let's look at it. MSCI has a CapEx of just 4% of revenue. Their operating margins expanded from 42% up to 55%.
Massive expansion.
Massive. Free cash flow jumped from $0.31 billion to $1.48 billion. And they took all that overflow and just relentlessly reduced their shares outstanding from 94 million down to 75 million.
They are as pure a free growth business as Visa, really. But MSCI has carried this overflow mechanic to its absolute logical conclusion.
Yeah, and this is where it gets crazy.
Right, they have returned so much capital for so long that they have actually repurchased their own book value completely out of existence.
Okay, hold on. Wait, let's stop right there and clarify this, because this is where, basic financial intuition usually breaks down.
It
If
does.
you pull up a balance sheet and you see negative shareholders' equity, every instinct says this company is in severe distress.
Right, you think they're failing.
Exactly. Doesn't negative equity usually mean a company is fundamentally insolvent, drowning in debt, or literally on the verge of bankruptcy? How does a money printer like MSCI have negative equity?
What's fascinating here is that in the context of a pure free growth business, negative equity is not distress at all.
It's not.
No, it is the mathematical endpoint of a business that simply cannot absorb its own cash. Think about how accounting actually works, right? Equity is just assets minus liabilities.
Right, standard accounting equation.
Right. So when a company is wildly profitable but has basically zero internal projects to fund, it uses all its cash. And, sometimes it even takes on very cheap, manageable debt to buy back its own
Because they
shares.
have nowhere else to put it.
Exactly. But they are buying those shares at very high market valuations, while the accounting only recognizes the much lower historical book value of the assets.
Ah, I see.
So when you do that relentlessly, year after year after year, your accounting equity basically just shrinks until it drops below zero.
So it's essentially an accounting illusion. The business is gushing cash, but because they fully accepted they could not enlarge their base, they just erased their equity line on paper.
It's the purest manifestation of the overflow carried to its absolute limit. They accepted their fixed quantity and chose to return the capital rather than destroy their rate of return by, forcing that capital into bad investments.
Okay, so Visa and MSCI both accepted the cap. They played the hand they were dealt. But S&P Global proved that not everyone actually wants to stay on that narrow base.
No, they certainly didn't.
What happens when a free growth business refuses the cap? What happens when a CEO generating massive returns decides, you know what, I want a larger base, and we are going to rebel against our own structural limits?
Well, you get a real-time case study in what it actually costs to force quantity into a model that's inherently designed to reject it.
So before 2022, S&P Global was an equilateral figure just like Visa. Their ratings franchise was a phenomenal free growth asset.
Unbelievable asset.
Right. It threw off cash with an ROIC exceeding 50% for 5 out of 6 years. Over 50%.
Which is just staggering.
But they wanted a bigger triangle. They wanted a larger base.
And a free growth business cannot organically build a massive base. That is the fundamental nature of the toll road, right? So if you want a larger base, you essentially have to go out into the market and buy one.
And in February 2022, they did. They took action. S&P Global acquired IHS Markit for $44 billion, paid in stock.
A massive deal.
Massive. In a single stroke, their shares outstanding ballooned from 241 million up to 325 million. The revenue jumped from $8.3 billion to $11.2 billion.
So they successfully converted the overflow of a free growth business into a larger base.
They bought the base, but the immediate consequence.
The fallout was brutal. The return collapsed instantly. Their ROIC went from 51.97% in 2021 all the way down to 12.69% in 2022.
Wow.
And by 2023, it was sitting at just 6.13%.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of why that return collapsed so violently. Because it wasn't a failure of the product, right?
Mm-hmm.
The underlying business didn't suddenly break.
Not at all.
Their financial data didn't become less valuable. Their operational quality didn't deteriorate. This was entirely a denominator problem.
Yes, exactly. A denominator problem.
Let's translate this for the listener. Return on invested capital is just a fraction. Return is on top. Invested capital is on the bottom.
Right.
When S&P bought IHS, $44 billion of goodwill and intangibles suddenly entered that bottom number. The denominator.
And goodwill and intangibles in this specific context represent the massive premium S&P had to pay over the actual accounting value of IHS Markit.
Because they had to pay the market price.
Exactly. They paid market price. Yeah. And purchase growth is never free. When you add $44 billion to your invested capital base, your denominator just skyrockets.
Right. And the profits on top of the numerator didn't grow anywhere near fast enough to keep up with that massive new base.
So you are explicitly trading your elite rate of return for a larger quantity base. The market priced that acquisition, and the percentage fell to match it.
S&P refused the cap, and the literal price they paid was surrendering their 50-something percent return.
Right. And what's incredibly telling is how S&P has operated ever since the ink dried on that acquisition.
They've been trying to undo it, basically.
They've been engaged in this massive purification process. They realized pretty quickly that holding a massive diluted base is far less attractive than holding a smaller elite one.
So they are actively expelling the pieces of that purchase base that don't compound like free growth assets.
Exactly.
I mean, look at the divestitures. They sold off Engineering Solutions to KKR for $975 million. They got rid of AustTRA. And they have this upcoming 2026 spinoff of their mobility business, which generates, what, $1.6 billion in revenue?
Yeah, about $1.6 billion. And, you know, you cannot undo a $44 billion purchase just by shedding $1.5 billion in revenue here and there. But they are desperately trying to purify the base to retain only that recurring financial data that acts like a toll.
And we are seeing the return slowly begin to recover as they shed that dead weight, right? And it went from 6.13% up to 8.95%, and now it's around 10.45%.
It is slowly recovering, yes. But the open question remains, and if you're holding S&P, you really have to ask yourself this. Can they actually hold on to a larger purchased base and fully restore their high rate of return?
Or have they permanently diluted a rare elite business into just a common, ordinary compounder?
And the coming years will answer that. I mean, if they fully recover their previous rate, they'll have achieved something the structure dictates is pretty much impossible, holding maximal rate and massive quantity together.
But the initial cost, that immediate destruction of their ROIC, was undeniable.
Totally undeniable.
So S&P proved that buying a new base off the shelf is mathematically punishing. But what if you don't buy it?
Right.
What if you build it from scratch? Which brings us to our last example, Alphabet.
Alphabet is fascinating.
They are executing the exact same rebellion against the cap, trying to force quantity into a free growth model. But they are doing it through construction instead of acquisition.
Yes. Alphabet is taking the pristine cash flows of one of the greatest pure free growth tolls in the history of capitalism, Google search.
An incredible toll road.
Incredible. And they are simply refusing to eject it as overflow.
Instead, they are pouring it into massive physical infrastructure. And I really want to contrast the physical reality of these businesses.
Oh, it's night and day.
Right. Visa is a software network. Pushing one more transaction through the Visa network costs fractions of a penny. Alphabet's rebellion, on the other hand, is made of concrete, steel, miles of fiber optic cables, and massive artificial intelligence server farms.
We are talking about cloud and AI capital expenditures measured in the tens of billions of dollars.
Tens of billions.
They are aggressively building a wildly capital-intensive new base.
But the crucial difference here, when we compare Alphabet's constructed base to S&P Global's purchase base, is the timing of the bill.
Exactly. When S&P bought IHS Markit, the cost was known immediately.
Right.
The purchase base hit the denominator at a set market price on day one, and the ROIC crashed instantly.
But for Alphabet, the bill has not yet come. The denominator is growing by tens of billions of dollars right now as they build out these data centers, but the market cannot yet price what that new physical base will actually return.
We don't know the numerator yet.
Right, we have no idea. So it raises this immense risk. Is building this costly new base going to productively absorb capital or just violently dilute their returns?
That's the existential question for Alphabet's model right now. They are betting that their internal rate of return on building this AI infrastructure will outpace the dilution of their massive capital expenditures.
It's an incredible risk to take a perfect business and basically wager its cash flows on a highly capital-intensive future. But there is a very fascinating data point regarding market validation here.
Berkshire Hathaway.
Yes. Berkshire Hathaway, who are arguably the most demanding, mathematically rigorous capital allocators on the planet. I mean, they're the very people who define the structural limits of high-return businesses in the first place.
Right. Buffett wrote the quote we opened with.
Exactly. And they took a position in Alphabet.
Which acts as a profound signal. The fact that Berkshire took a position is a calculated wager that Alphabet's massive constructed base will ultimately be absorbed productively rather than wasted.
They're betting Alphabet is the rare exception.
Exactly. They're betting Alphabet can successfully construct a massive new quantity without permanently destroying their elite rate.
So let's pull all of this together. Because we have these four distinct archetypes operating within this framework from the infinite investor.
Right.
You have Visa, representing the pure archetype, just accepting the mathematical cap and overflowing cash back to the shareholder.
Yep.
You have MSCI, taking that exact same strategy to its absolute mathematical limit by using that cash to erase its own book value completely.
The ultimate overflow.
Then you have the rebels. S&P Global rebelling by buying a larger base and instantly surrendering their elite rate.
Right.
And finally, Alphabet rebelling by building a massive physical base, deferring the ultimate judgment of the market to some unknown date in the future.
And the synthesis of all four examples, the ultimate core thesis here, is that the cap is the price.
The cap is the price.
A true free growth business receives everything but can enlarge nothing. The rate of return is maximal precisely because the quantity is fixed.
Right.
The moment you attempt to exceed that cap, you pay for it with your rate. You either surrender it immediately, like S&P did when they bought their base, or you wager it against an uncertain future, as Alphabet is doing by building theirs.
It leaves you with such a profound, lingering question to ponder as an investor. If you are looking at the most exceptional companies on Earth right now, are they all eventually backed into this exact mathematical corner?
It seems structurally inevitable.
Right. Is the ultimate fate of every brilliant capital compounder to either eventually dilute its own greatness just to chase a larger base, or simply hand their cash back to a market that honestly has nowhere better to put it?
It's a fascinating dilemma.
It really is. This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.